Welcome to the Full of Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 5:45 British Summer Time. Well, this being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. But before I start on those, let's just have a look at where the markets have been today. And the consumer confidence number that came out in the US earlier on was a bit lower than expected. The prior to this it was 84, the survey was 83.8, and today it came at 78.7, so quite a bit lower than people had expected. And it didn't have any particular effect on the stock markets. On the other hand, it did have a bit of an effect on the precious metals. And the reason for that was because, well, if you've got slower consumer confidence, that points towards a slowing economy, which points towards no more interest rate hikes, which means that they're not as afraid of inflation as they was, and since gold and precious metals are a hedge against inflation, they're coming off a bit. So silver is back towards its consolidation lows. It's at 1193 right now. Again, it would have to fall back into that prior range, which is the sort of the July range, to break the consistency of the uptrend, and it hasn't done that quite yet. My silver position is rolling forward this evening, and I'll give details of that on Monday when it's been completed. I'm just letting them. I was tempted to buy a bit of the December this morning and let the September expire, but I said I wasn't going to be too sophisticated, and I'm just going to let them roll it forward when the contract expires this evening. Excuse me. So that was the more or less the biggest piece of news that came out today. Stock markets were generally quiet in here. The Nikkei was up about a half of 1%. The ASX in Australia held up yesterday's good gain. It was down just 3 points, which is almost unchanged in the day. In Europe, you had a relatively mixed day, but very steady in general. The FTSE was up 3. It had been up quite a bit more than that, but gave most of it up after that consumer confidence number came out. The DAX was down 16 points, so really quite a steady day in European markets. And you're seeing pretty much the same thing in the US right now. The Dow is up 7, the S&P is up half a point, and the Nasdaq is down 5. So really quite a quiet day in here. And given that it's the 18th of August and it's a Friday, it wouldn't be surprising if we didn't see too much action, given that people might be tempted to just take today off. I know that quite a few people in the office here have taken holidays today, so that might be an explanation for the quietness in the market, in the stock markets. The Treasury markets are relatively steady in here as well. The 30-year is up 8 points, 109.18. 10-year is up 5 at 106.26, and you've got 0.41% move in the gilts and 0.16 of a percent in, or sorry, 1.16 of a point in the bunds. Oil has steadied up a little bit in here today. It has been as low as 69.60. It's currently at 70.45, and the high of the day was around $71. So you're getting a little bit of steadying coming in here. Natural gas has firmed up in the last hour or so. It was as high as 6.94, having been as low as 6.52. So that's quite a large range in the day. It's currently up 16 points. And one thing looking at that chart is that it's coming down quite a bit slower than it went up, which means that if we do get a test of the $6 mark, I think there'll be plenty of demand around that level. And given we don't know, of course, it may well hold the gain that we've seen in here today. Given that you had that Escondida mine shutting with copper, hasn't moved a whole pile in here today. It's up 6.50. And given that yesterday was a relatively weak day for the industrial metals, nickel is up 300 points at 28,000 even. Lead is flat on the day, and zinc is up 79 points at 3,280. It's also been quite a quiet day for the currency markets, with the yen and the euro relatively flat in here. Now, I'm moving on to the sort of the bigger picture themes, and given that we've had such a lot of talk about the inflation fears abating over the last week. Let's kick off with the inflation talk. Well, first things first, we've had a generational long period, I think, ending really in 2003, where inflation wasn't a problem at all. And you had plenty of commentators, and respected commentators at that, saying that we're in a new era and that you've got growth without inflation, and they were right for quite a long time. The main fears were deflationary, and every time there was a panic in the markets, the central bank stepped in and they flooded the market with liquidity. And examples of those, in really no particular chronological order, were the Asian financial crisis, the Russian debt default, Y2K, then you had the Nasdaq crash, you had 9/11, and every time something like this happened, there was a great deflationary fear that the markets wouldn't be able to recover from such a blow, and central banks flooded the market with liquidity. Now you might say, how did they do something like that? Well, the most obvious way is just to go ahead and print money. But of course, printing paper money is not really what we talk about when we say about printing money. What we're really looking at is the fact that they made lending just so much easier by first lowering the cost of money by dropping interest rates. And they did that quite spectacularly after the Nasdaq crash and then again after 9/11, one following the other very, very shortly afterwards. So they lowered the cost of money very, very abruptly and brought the US borrowing rates down to 1%. But what they also did on the monetary side is they increased the amount of liquidity in the market. So the velocity of money went up and they made it much, much widely available, much more widely available. They also encouraged the lending institutions to lend money. So not only did they make it cheap, which stimulates demand, they also made it quite easy for people to borrow. And right now we have, although they don't publish M3 for the US anymore, in the UK and Europe you have M3 running at about 4 times the rate of GDP growth, which means that we're still in a very lax monetary environment, even though the cost of that money is going up. Excuse me, I'm just going to take a drink of water. Pardon me. So that means that they very successfully avoided the deflationary slump that we'd seen in Japan. Now, Japan and the Nasdaq bubble show remarkable similarities, and if you look at them on an overlay chart, they're the classic examples of bull markets that end in acceleration and in mania. However, you're not getting the same type of bear market in the US, in particularly the Nasdaq that you got in, or the S&P that you got in Japan. And that's purely because of the amount of liquidity that's been pumped into the system. When the Japanese decided to prick their bubble, they squeezed tight and they didn't let up squeezing for quite a long time after the bubble had burst. And they pushed their economy into a 14, 15-year downward spiral. Whereas in the US, they pumped all this liquidity into the market. And that has helped to stimulate growth. So when you look at the Dow Jones, and we say that the Dow Jones is in a generation-long period of P/E ratio contraction and rising dividend yields, so that's our definition of a bear market, you can see that it's almost at its highs right now. But when you look at it in terms of relative performance versus some of the other stock markets around the world, it's not doing particularly well. And then if you look at the Nasdaq, which was the real victim of the bubble, then that is nowhere near its all-time highs and likely will not see them for at least a couple of decades. But going back quickly to inflation, Because you have this incredible amount of liquidity floating around in the market and continuing to be pumped into the world economy, into the financial markets, then deflation was probably a real threat 6 years ago. But the chances are that really, in actual fact, that they have stoked a new period of inflation. And while we've had inflationary fears mounting for the last 5 or 6 months and now starting to abate as the Fed has paused rising interest rates, then they are looking for an opportunity to stop to not only to stop raising interest rates but to lower interest rates to protect the economy. Because when you've got all this money floating around the place, it floats into just about every single aspect of the financial markets it can. And one very simple way for money to flow into people's pockets very quickly is through the housing markets. And the rising cost of money is like a margin call on speculative investors in property. And we can see that there is certainly a housing slowdown in the US. Now, people who own houses also tend to vote, and while the Treasury is certainly independent, it is also, and its chairman have often been very political animals. And with elections coming up, midterm elections coming up, are they really going to want to see not a slowing economy but a recessionary economy? Definitely not. So, while PPI and CPI have given us good numbers just recently, they're going to be looking for any excuse so that they can create, or it's not create, but they can claim at least a Pyrrhic victory over inflation. And if they do see recessionary threats starting to creep into the economy, they're going to lower interest rates. Of course, as soon as they start doing that, that's giving the boon to those inflationary fears once more, which will almost certainly be ignored, just like they were ignored over the last 2 or 3 years, until they actually become a real threat to the stability of the economy, at which point they'll start acting strongly again. Now, that means that over the course of time, we're going to have inflationary and deflationary periods. But those inflationary periods mean that interest rates are probably going to go up that little bit higher than people had expected, and they're not going to fall nearly as much as people expect when interest rates start coming back. So we're in the early stages of a new inflationary cycle. We've already seen gold accelerate up to a high around $750. It's currently at $6.08, so in a medium-term correction. And as we move around towards a period where there's the possibility of interest rate cuts and where the inflationary fears may be ignored, we could be looking at a period where gold is underperforming, but it's still very much within an overall uptrend, and the upside for gold is probably multiples of where it is today. But of course, that's probably not going to happen in 2006. We're probably going to see that over the next decade and more as the inflationary cycle really starts to gain pace. And as I said, we're still very much within the early stages of that. Now, looking again then at the secular bear market on Wall Street, because you have this liquidity flowing in and supporting the markets, what we're seeing is that the Dow is close to its highs, the S&P is still in very healthy, it's still very healthy, and the Nasdaq is, well, basing really, after the spike in 2000, 1999, 2000. But the important factor is that when we talk about the Wall Street leash effect, because we can look at how good the US markets are doing, but the chances are that the US markets are going to underperform global markets for the foreseeable future. So while you might get 5 and 6 and 10% gains in the S&P in a year, if the US markets are going up, that means liquidity is abundant, and liquidity will find its way into the best opportunities, and those will outperform by multiples on the upside. So emerging markets are going to be higher beta. Europe has outperformed enormously this year. I'm just looking at the WI page on Bloomberg, and the Dow Jones, when you look at it in dollar terms, is up 5.81% this year. The Stoxx 50 in Europe is up 12.78%, and if you were in the best performing of the European markets, which was Spain, you'd be up 21.78% in dollar terms. So that can tell you how much a developed market, which is not in the secular bear market that US markets are in, can outperform. But when we look at markets like India, which is our favorite emerging market for the very long term, that can outperform really very significantly. You might say, what about Japan? Well, Japan is, we think, is in the early stages of a new bull market, but those are the early stages. And it has been in a deflationary slump for really a very long time. And with the refinancing of the banks in 2003 and the unwinding of the cross ownerships and various other reforms, the Nikkei did remarkably well last year. But that's still creating that first step above the base, which we often talk about. The first step above the base is where you get a very good rally out of the base. But once you've had that rally and people look around and say, okay, we're up, I think when the Nikkei did it last year, it rallied from about 12,000 to 15,000, and then people get to 15,000, and where's it going to go next? And what's really changed? The bearish arguments start to get a bit of a hold, and you move into a consolidation, and that's what we've got in the Nikkei right now. But the Nikkei, this is a first step above the base, and as soon as that's ended, which would be a break to a new high and a consolidation in that area, that's when we would, with confidence, say that we've completed that first step, then we can expect it to move into a more consistent uptrend. And I would say with confidence that the Nikkei will hit its high well before the Nasdaq goes back to test its all-time high. Now, the reason that I say that is because the Nikkei has gone through its secular bear market, whereas the Nasdaq is still very much in the basing formation, and there's no sign yet that that's over, and it's unlikely that that will be over for the foreseeable future because that was such a big bubble. Now, the reason that we're big fans of India is India has all of the plus sides of China. It has the fantastic population, great resources. It has an incredible diaspora of educated people and wealthy people willing to invest back in their countries. But it also has democracy, rule of law, property rights, independent judiciary, independent central banks, none of which China has. Now, of course, China has centralized control, so they have a fantastic lead in infrastructure. However, once India starts to get its act together on getting that infrastructure built, then it could quite easily move up to contend with China. Now, I think the overriding fact that really sways it, though, is because India has financial markets that are very similar to our own in the first world, and that's what they aspire to. Whereas China's stock market is very much dictated by politics. So that means that if you put your money in India, the chances are it'll still be there in 20 years' time when you want to cash out. Whereas in China, you're at the mercy of whim of the apparatchiks, and right now it's in their interests for the stock market to do well, but that won't always be the case. So it's just a cautionary note if you're investing in China, just to keep an eye on the political situation there all the time. Now, when we look at stock markets, you can't look at stock markets without also thinking about the bond market. And with the bond market, we have to go back and look at that inflationary cycle once more, because bond prices have been in a bull market for the last 20 years. And I would argue that that is pretty much over. You have yields starting to move out of their base, And I think that's best seen in the PNF charts. You don't really see it in the long-term candle charts. I think if you look at the candle charts, it looks like it's moved up to test the downtrend. And that's certainly an argument. If you look at the PNF charts, it looks pretty conclusive that it's breaking up from its base. So right now we've got bonds rallying from an area of support. They had been in a downtrend for a couple of months. They found some support, and now they're starting to rally out of that. But over the very long term, and this obvious, they're obviously moving in line with interest rate expectations. Excuse me. They're obviously moving in line with interest rate expectations. So we could get a bond rally going on for the next couple of months. However, they're probably not going to go on and make new highs, and over time we're probably going to see a progression of lower highs. And when we look at longer term charts for bonds, it's much better to talk about yields. And right now we have yields moving up out of their base. We have still to see them create that first step above the base. But once they've done that, we would expect those to move into a gradual uptrend, a more consistent uptrend, but that would take a number of years. So we will have periods where bonds will trend upwards in price, but those will be relatively short to medium term, whereas when they fall, they'll fall quite a bit more than they will have rallied. So that's something to keep an eye on and to be aware of. For the very long term, because we're going to get a secular bear market in bond prices, and we're in a secular bear market in US equities, what we can sort of expect, and I suspect this will probably be the best investment opportunity of my lifetime, will be in 15 to 20 years' time, when we're at the nadir of the bond bear market, where interest rates are much higher than they are now, where we can buy bonds yielding 14 and 15% in AAA rated instruments in our own local currencies. And once we have those, we'll be able to take our coupons every half or every year and reinvest them in the stock market, which will be a cost averaging type affair. And I think that will be the very best opportunity to get value that I can see. But right now, valuations are in the US are still really quite overvalued, and I think it will take a long time for them to come back to very cheap levels. We have seen them come back quite a lot, but the fact that we still have the amount of liquidity in the market, I think, does distort the rate at which the valuations are coming back. And I think it would be at least that amount of time, at least a couple of decades, before we see the US starting to move back to leadership in the global stock markets. Not leadership in the in terms of its influence, because it will always have an incredible influence on other stock markets, but leadership in the fact that when you want to invest, it will be the very best stock market in relative terms to invest in, and that's certainly not the case today. Looking at currencies, and the currencies are also massively involved with the liquidity story, because with the amount of liquidity that's floating out there, it's really an effort by central banks to inflate their way out of trouble. And the fact that we have gold moving up in just about every currency means that investors are gradually starting to get to the idea, or get the idea, that gold is a long-term store of value. Now, that certainly wasn't the case for much of the last 15 to 20 years, but I would argue that it is certainly moving in that direction now. So, when we have gold moving up in just about every currency, what's the prognosis for those actual individual currencies? Well, the fact of the matter is that because of the competitive nature of globalization, no country wants a strong currency, and because all currencies are fiat based, so that means that they're not fixed to any, they're not valued by any particular fixed asset, then countries can manipulate the value of their currencies quite easily. The reason that we haven't got one currency that is absolutely stronger than all others, without the shadow of a doubt or no argument, is because no country wants a strong currency. As soon as you start getting a strong currency, your exporters who have consolidated earnings in your particular currency will start to whinge, and you'll get quite a lot of bleating from politicians and whatnot. So there's an effort to keep the value of the currency within a certain band. That pretty much means that you're not going to see very big trends in the reserve currencies of the world, the dollar, the yen, the euro, the Swiss franc, those sorts of currencies, because they don't want a strong currency. And what that means is that the amount of liquidity that's getting pumped into the system and the amount of money that's being pumped through M3, so much in excess of GDP growth is there, and it seems to be holding the currencies in a relative balance. That's why we've had the dollar index moving more or less sideways for the last year or so. And I don't anticipate, for at least for the moment anyway, or at least as the situation continues the way it is, that we're going to see the reserve currencies trending very much against each other. What we could see are some of the Asian currencies starting to appreciate. For example, the Singapore dollar. I mean, Singapore has ambitions of becoming the Switzerland of Asia, and they're probably not going to fight too hard against having a stronger currency. And obviously, China is being pushed or begged to allow its currency to strengthen. Well, as that gradually happens, it means the Asian dollar index will probably appreciate and is certainly in an uptrend versus the Asian currencies. Now, our other great, well, great is probably too strong a word, but our one of our other great investment themes is the supply and elasticity meets rising demand, because the last commodity bull market was in the 70s, and I was born in the 70s, so I certainly don't remember it, and the vast majority of people in the markets today don't remember it. But what we had since then was a grinding bear market in industrial commodities. And that meant that if you wanted to survive in the industry, you had to mine the easiest ore first. And as soon as prices went up a bit, you didn't really reinvest in plant, but you put away, you made stockpiles, that sort of thing. But of course, because it was also in a bear market, you didn't have the capacity to hire new people, so the average age of workers in the mining executive is relatively old. All those young engineers who would normally have gone into mining more or less went into environmental studies, and that was an enemy to mining in general, although perhaps not to the environment. Of course, over the last 20 years, you've also had a lot of environmental legislation going through, which means it's much more difficult to open a mine right now. Now, because you have China and India building an incredible amount of infrastructure, not to mention the rest of emerging Asia and the Middle East, and increasingly in South America, and sooner or later, we're going to have that type of infrastructural develop happening in Africa, although that's not happening right now. But what that has done is created an incredible demand for industrial commodities. The uptrends that you see in, and you'll find them all in the chart library, but those uptrends have been massive breakouts from generational long bases. We wouldn't expect those to just end abruptly, and what we're seeing at the moment is a medium-term correction. Now, the fact that people are talking about metal prices today and saying that metal prices are weak, I think is laughable. A medium-term correction means that copper has come from 400 to 300, but 5 years ago copper was at 100. So that tells us that people are starting to get the idea that metal prices around these levels are acceptable. Now, it could be 6 months, it could be a year before we see these metals starting to break up from these consolidations. But we're not going to see them move back into their bases. That means that with demand coming through from emerging Asia, I mean, there are 5.5 billion people in the emerging markets who aspire to our standard of living, and they're going to do whatever it takes to get there. That means that there's going to be increased demand and increased competition for natural resources, and the prices are only going up over the very long term. Obviously, right now we're in a consolidation, but this consolidation won't last forever, certainly not, and the long term will probably see industrial commodities multiply many fold from where they are right here. When you take that in conjunction with the demand coming from the emerging world, and you put that together with the new inflationary cycle, then you can look at the inflation-adjusted charts that we have in the chart library, and there isn't a single industrial commodity has made a new high relative to the highs that it had back in the 70s in inflation-adjusted terms, which means that these things can go up beyond our imaginations. Just probably not this year, and maybe not even next year. When we look at nickel, nickel had a fantastic break above its base, but then it consolidated for 2 years, and a lot of the investors just forgot about it. And since then, it has nearly doubled again. So the consolidations can be lengthy, but once they start to move up out of those consolidations, they can go up really quite a lot. But that's the those are the major themes that we're focusing on over the long term. The last one is energy. Now, oil is currently up 74 cents. It's at $70.80 right now. So that's rallied since I started giving the audio. But oil's highs were at $40 only 3 or 4 years ago. And those were considered extraordinary levels. And since then, it's moved up out of the base and it's moved into a consistent uptrend with a progression of rising lows. And that progression of rising lows hasn't broken. Now, the fact that you have a lot of nervousness in the market. I mean, I wasn't surprised, but I suppose I was a bit surprised, really, that the Lebanese conflict got so many headlines with regard to the oil price, because neither of them were oil producers. Now, I know that there's a threat, there was a threat from Iran supporting Hezbollah, but that was very much under the table. That's like China using North Korea for its proxy arms dealer. But what I find interesting is the fact that there is quite so much nervousness in the markets with regard to the oil price. And I believe that the most important factor is that refineries are operating at 91% on average. That means that just a couple of refineries need to get knocked out for one reason or another. And running at 90% means that there is no time for maintenance. And the market is well aware of that, and that puts pressure on demand, on supply. We know that there's plenty of oil out there, and we're not going to run out of oil anytime soon. What we may run out of is cheap oil, but plenty of alternative sources of oil become viable around $40, not $70. So we're certainly not going to run out of oil. But I believe that we're very much within an uptrend here. We haven't seen any kind of acceleration, which means that even if we do break the progression of rising lows, we're just going to move into a consolidation phase. And that could see oil ranging around a $20 range for a year or more. And I believe that's the worst case scenario. I don't think that we're going to see oil coming back to $40. I certainly don't think we're going to see oil coming back to $10. Which means that oil and its proxies are going to be in uptrends for the foreseeable future, along with the industrial commodities. I think oil is probably the best of the plays in one sense, because you can recycle metals, but you can't recycle oil once you've burned it. But that's it for me. David's going to be back in I think in on Thursday, I think, that's the 24th. I'm reading this book on liquidity at the moment, and I think I'll probably finish it over the weekend, so I'll write a review about that on Monday. But thank you very much for your time, and have a very good weekend.